as we're going through Hell Week, all of a sudden I'm getting stressed to limits that I've never been stressed to before, because that's what Buds is designed to do. You either choose me or we, and they want the people that choose we because it's a team. I was going through my own little injuries at the time. They told me, hey, look, you're going to get rolled back.
That's Ryan Hendrickson, U.S. Army Special Forces soldier, decorated war hero, and best-selling author.
I said, I'm not rolling back. I'm done. And so I gave up on myself. It took me forever to understand that that failure at Buds, because I was so disgusted with what happened there, that when I went through Special Forces training, I never was going to go back to that disgusting part of my life again. And so it actually paved the way for me to become a Green Beret.
I'm Michael Mogul, founder and CEO of Crisp, the nation's number one law firm growth company. I've built my business through practice, not theory. Crisp started with just $500 to my name and has grown to over eight figures in revenue over the last few years, earning a spot on the Inc. 500 list of the fastest growing private companies in America. Our approach has been to take everything we've learned about generating massive growth within our own organization and help the country's most ambitious and committed law firm owners do the same for theirs. In each episode of this podcast, I sit down with innovative market leaders from the legal industry and beyond to learn from those who thrive in the face of adversity, challenge the status quo, and define what it means to be a true game changer. Today, we're revisiting one of our most popular episodes from the podcast, where I sat down with Ryan Hendrickson to discuss the importance of being a team player, how to develop a mindset of extreme ownership, and why failure beats regret.
But the difference, I think, between quitting on yourself and not making the cut is this. If you gave it everything you possibly had, if I don't make the cut, then I know that I gave it all I had, and I will hold my head high because I knew, hey, look, if I don't make this, if I gave it everything that I have mentally, physically, emotionally, everything, if I leave it all out there, then there are no regrets. If everybody who is just left standing in the end is going to get a Green Beret, then it's not special.
That's coming up on the Game Changing Attorney Podcast. Before we begin today's episode, I want to remind you that we aren't beholden to any sponsors or run any ads on this podcast. This allows us to present all of our episodes raw and unfiltered. I'm not going to push any made-to-order meal services on you or try to save you any money on your car insurance. That being said, I have one small request. If you receive any value from this podcast, please give it a 5-star review. Pay the fee so we can keep this podcast free. Ryan Hendrickson is the definition of a hero. As a U.S. Army Special Forces soldier, his many decorations include the Silver Star, 4 Bronze Stars, a Purple Heart, and an Army Commendation Medal with Valor. He's also the author of Tip of the Spear, an inspiring true story of how he was medically retired after stepping on an IED and his incredible return to active duty. I began our conversation by asking Ryan how he came to the decision to share his story with the world.
I was in Afghanistan 2010, 2012, so not a big deal there. And then 16, 17, 18, 19. Then as a contractor, 20 and 21. So that's a lot of years in Afghanistan. And after the 16 trip, you know, some stuff happened and I was really trying to figure it out. You can go to a bar with your buddies. Like if you and I went to a bar, it's like, yeah, man, this happened, this happened, this happened. And then we talk about it and it feels good for a minute. But then you go home to your life and your family and I go home to my life and my family and it's all dead air. And so I had a buddy, and he's actually the chaplain of 7th Special Forces Group. And he said, you know, have you ever thought about writing? Yeah, writing. Okay, whatever. I majored in writing in like the third grade. And he goes, no, seriously. Like some people actually, because you're not letting go of it, you're just taking it from one place and putting it to another. And you can revisit that place anytime you want. So the 2017 deployment, I was just kind of in a dark place. Let me check out this little writing thing he's talking about. Let's see. And yeah, Microsoft Word, and just started typing and typing and typing and typing and typing. And then it turned into days and weeks and months. And next thing you know, I just hundreds of pages of just stuff. And it's just pouring out. And then I went back and I kind of organized it to the way, you know, the book reads. And I was just like, holy cow. Like, that feels good and I can come and get it anytime I want. But with all that work put into it, we're humans. So I was like, I wonder what people would think about this. So I had a couple of buddies read it. And if you want a brutally honest answer, ask another Green Beret. because you're going to get a brutally honest answer. And I figured, you know, I'm going to get the normal, you know, the Raz. But no, my two friends came back and they're like, dude, that's me. Like, that story is me. It's like, okay. So then family, they're like, yeah, people need to read this. I don't know if there's such thing called writing therapy. Maybe. I don't know. If not, I would really like to, what do you call it? Trademark it or something? But yeah, I'd really like to do that. But I think there is, because it was awesome for me. And I took all that and got the courage from something my dad said to me. And I was like, I don't want to release this. I don't want it to be a book, because I don't want people to know that kind of stuff about me. He goes, wow, aren't you just a selfish asshole? It's like, what? He goes, yeah, if this book could help one person, but you're going to hold it back because you think you're so cool that people are going to judge you by this. Check it out there, boy. You're not that cool. And your story, like, this story can reach somebody, but you're so worried about what people are going to think about you that you don't want it to help anybody. He goes, you need to get over yourself.
And it sounds like your dad has been pretty instrumental back to childhood. You know, if you got to speak to your upbringing, maybe some of the things that have kind of shaped you.
My dad came from a pretty low point in life. Even from when he was brought up, he was one of six boys. They lived in a shack, dirt floor, whatnot like that, in a place, it's crazy, it's called Pollywog Springs in Oregon. Those aren't excuses to be an asshole, but it helped shape his life. And then a couple tours in Vietnam, and then coming back and booze running his life. And he got to a point to where, you know, it's like, hey, I'm going to fix things. We were in the truck and we were driving over to my Uncle Steve's house, which wasn't really a step up from my dad, because my Uncle Steve was an alcoholic too. But driving over to drop my sister and I off, and then he was going to go out and he was going to shoot himself in the head. And that was the night that, you know, he was approached by a guy who ended up being a Christian and a preacher. And that was the night my dad was saved.
It's like the come to Jesus moment, literally.
Literally, right before he, yeah. And so that's what kind of started him on the path he was, from the lowest point, you know, in life. And then if I could have just looked back on my dad's life and understood, like, wow, he was at this point, he, you know, was saved, and then life started going good again, then we got hit, and we got hit, and we got hit, and then I would have understood, like, hey, look, wow, this is crazy, but life's not fair. And the minute you can figure out that life's not fair is when you start to actually enjoy life. And when you figure out that life can be very brutal, and you accept it, and you understand it, and you know that you're not, like, nobody owes you anything, and you're not entitled to anything, that's when you can actually start to enjoy life. But before then, it took me, years to figure out that I'm not owed a damn thing. And all I had to do was look back on my dad's life and my life growing up, and I could have, figured that kind of stuff out. So
I imagine that, kind of looking back now, you look at it through a different lens. But growing up as a kid, you describe a point where you're living in a tent. Which I don't think, you say you didn't really mind the tent. It was more about if some of the kids in school saw that you were living in a tent. I guess if you could speak to that.
We didn't have a lot of money growing up. And, you know, I'm always borderline with, poor me, I grew up poor or something like that. But I've been around the world and I've seen poor. I didn't grow up bad at all. But yes, I lived in a tent for about a year. Let's be realistic here. This wasn't a little camping tent. We had it was a nice tent. I mean, it could fit like five, six people. It wasn't bad. But that was a chip on my shoulder for a long time, until I started to understand that, number one, life's not fair. Number two, I looked around, I was like, I don't really have it that bad. So, but yeah, it did. It shaped a lot of my childhood, just because of that's not normal.
Even in school, I know you talk about playing football, being on the wrestling team, and having this level of toughness, almost like this resilience, where your coach said that you were too stupid to quit,
yeah,
which could have been taken as an insult, but you wore it as a badge of honor. Where do you think that toughness and resilience came from?
Well, I mean, the too stupid to quit part, I think, is just because I literally am just too stupid to quit. But I think that toughness Well, I don't think I know that toughness came from my dad, because at an early age, whether I understood it or not, I understood that nothing's free and you have to work for what you get, and no one owes you anything and you're not going to get anything unless you work for it. In my life, I look back and there's times when I've quit on myself. And so it's like, yeah, you're too stupid to quit maybe at wrestling. But I do have points in my life where I was like, wow, I could have done so much more, but I just gave up. So yes and no, but the too stupid to quit part, I think that's just, that's the wrestling thing. And my coach is like, man, you're getting your head tore off over there. And the guy just got tired. And I was like, yeah, I win. He goes, well, you didn't really win. You just outlasted. And I'm like, yeah. Wait, is that good? He's like, you're dumb. I was like, all right.
Well, I mean, I guess there's something to be said for that, because that sort of resilience and toughness, just sticking in there long enough, that seems to pay off later too, right? I mean, anytime we encounter any challenges, it's, I mean, sometimes you just stick with it.
Yep.
And I mean, as simple as don't quit.
Yeah.
You know, you ultimately end up getting there. Now, I want to talk about kind of the journey into the military, because obviously, I mean, you had your dad who was a veteran as well, but was it always going to be the military, or do you have other things that you considered?
From a young age, I was pretty much geared for the military, whether it was out playing army in the woods at, you know, a young age or whatnot like that. My dad had pretty much, my mindset was military. Now, as I got to high school, you know, I started focusing on girls and whatnot like that. Same thing everybody does. And my dad's like, look, dude, you're 18. You're graduating soon. He said, I refuse to let you be that 40-some-odd-year-old man at the gas station talking about your homecoming game, your senior year, you know, of high school at 40-some-odd years old. He's like, look, you can do whatever you want. You can go work a job. You can go to college, but let's face it, you're not really college material. You can join the military. I highly recommend it, but you can't stay here, because if I let you stay here, you'll never leave. So you got to go, dude. Because his belief was, hey, look, it's 4 years of your life. Go serve your country. That's our belief, is do something for your country. And when you get done, then figure out what you want to do. But you're 18. You don't know shit. You're a kid. So go join the military, figure it out. And then 4 years turned into 8 years, turned into, you know, 12 and whatnot. Next thing you know, I'm like, wow, to where I'm sitting right now, and I have no idea what I want to do when I grow up, you know?
So when you join, you went Navy. And then I think you described at one point you're thinking I might be on just working on board a submarine. And I think 2 seconds later, you're like, I don't like tight and closed spaces.
Oh my gosh. No. Yeah. I made it to like the first tour of a submarine in Groton, Connecticut. And I was like, nope, can't do this at all. And they're, I'm glad we found out now, because we don't want you in our community. So it's straight out to the surface fleet. So.
Even just starting out, you're working these long days, 10, 12, 14, 16-hour days. A lot of the things you're doing, I mean, it's just a lot of, like, cleanup and so on. What was your approach towards that? Like, kind of what was your attitude towards what could be seen as grunt work, that sort of thing?
So I was a deckhand, a bosun's mate. Amazing job. But, yeah, you're a grunt. And you're doing the basic work on a ship that has to get done. But for me, it was easy because it's how I grew up, you know, farm work, logging. And so for me, it was an easy transition over. But if I was looking at some of the other rates out there, I was like, man, that guy's he's a sonar technician. And man, that guy works on radars and stuff like that. I was like, I'll just go over here and chip this paint and put some primer on it so it doesn't rust. And, you know, that was my world. I loved it. It was a great life because I learned so much. And being a bosun's mate I know somebody listening to this may contradict it, but it's the core of the Navy, in my opinion. I had a blast. So horrible, yep. But I had a blast.
So you go through this, you kind of finish this 4-year commitment in the Navy, and then you get out back into civilian life. And I think you was reading, you're bartending, you're doing this type of stuff. I think going back into civilian life, that was probably, you know, a bit of a change. You didn't like it very much.
No. No, I didn't like it at all. I got out April 2001. So 9/11 hadn't kicked off yet and whatnot. And when 9/11 happened, then my wheels started turning in. But, you know, my relationship at the time, and I really thought that it would be, we're going to go in, bomb the crap out of them, and it'll be over with. And so I'll just continue doing what I'm doing. But I just, I couldn't wrap my head around the lackadaisical mindset. It's like, well, you know, I mean, it's 9:15. I'm not that late. You're still late. What are you talking about? I mean, there's a time. Well, I mean, is anything really going on between 9 and 9:15? You're still late. I just couldn't wrap my mind around it. And I couldn't understand, but I didn't have the, I guess you would call it maybe like the negotiation skills that I learned later on in life. And so I would be confrontational right off the bat. And that's not good for a workplace. And so for me, it's like, yeah, this guy is wrong, but you can't threaten to fight everybody because that doesn't do good in the workplace. So yeah, but he's wrong. I know, but you can't. So yeah, I had a hard time playing well with others. You know, it's like, oh man, we were just so drunk last night. That's why I'm late. Yeah, so was I, but I'm here on time.
And are you the type of person that just likes like to just a lot of structure and having that regimen? Is that something that you like to have?
I thrive in those environments. Like my dad was very structured. You're going to do it this way because I said so. I pay the bills. I put food in your mouth. If you don't like it, well, start paying bills and then you can have a say so. But, you know, until you pay bills and you've served your country, you don't have a voice. So shut up and do what I tell you. And it's like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So I actually thrive with structured direction. If somebody can give me a task, condition, and a standard, I'm fine. But if I have all three of those, you're going to get the best Ryan Hendrickson. That's a military thing, task, condition, standard. And I'm going to thrive. And so, yes, it's weird for a Green Beret to say, but if I'm in an environment where I have direction that is given to me, like, hey, this is what needs to be accomplished, and these are your right and left limits, and this is what you have to work with, I'm good to go. If someone's like, hey, what do you think about this? Let's do something. I'm going to struggle, and then I'll research who has done this something before and their task condition standard. Then I'll set my own task condition standard and then accomplish the mission. But if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about, you know, just even from a leadership standpoint, when you're leading people, that seems like a pretty consistent way to get a desired result, right? Because if you leave, you know, if there's not boundaries, if there aren't conditions, if it's too open-ended, if the clarity doesn't exist,
yep,
then you can still get a result, just might not be the result that you want.
Yep. And as a leader, if you don't have a set task, condition, and standard, or that clarity is not there, then when the mission is accomplished, but it's not accomplished to what you wanted, can't go after the team for that, because they were missing one of those three, either a task or a condition or a standard. And so as a leader, if you just give them a blanket, like, hey, I would like this to happen, let's make it happen. Then when they come up with their, we call it a COA, but their course of action. When they come up with their course of action and it's not to your liking, then again, they didn't have a task, condition, and standard to go by. So you have to come back to, as a leader, if you want it to be this way, your way, which you can because you're the leader or the CEO or whatever it is, then you have to give those parameters, those right and left limits, those task conditions and standards, or else people aren't mind readers. Some leaders suffer because they don't have a set task, condition, and standard, or they'll promote, I want free thinkers. I want people that will think outside of the box and do X, Y, Z, which is great. You can't have your own standard and expect people to meet that standard if they don't know what that standard is because you told them to think outside the box and be the, I want you painting in the gray.
Yep.
You either adopt it and you can, you know, work with everybody's opinion or everybody's course of action, their COAs in the gray, or you have a set task, condition, and standard, and this is how I like it. And for me, both are great leadership styles. I just thrive better when I have a task, condition, and a standard.
Yeah.
Because if I don't have it, then I'm going to find out who did it before, find out what their task, condition, standard was, and I'm going to adopt mine to that because that's just how my brain works.
So it's interesting. I actually really appreciate how honest you were in this book because there was a lot of things you could have left out or had written it in a way where it's just wins and here's all the things that went right and I made every right decision. Everything was good.
It's not life.
But you're honest. There's a part where this was certainly something I think you could have left out. Book would have been just fine. And it was, I think, your experience when you wanted to be like a naval reservist thing and going through BUDS, mm-hmm. right? If you could speak to that.
Yeah, so I wanted to be a Navy SEAL. Those dudes are hardcore and all that. But what I didn't take into consideration is not everybody's Charlie Sheen on the movie Navy SEALs. So when I got to BUDS, I was physically prepared, but I wasn't mentally prepared. And so as we're going through Hell Week, all of a sudden, I'm getting stressed to limits that I've never been stressed to before, because that's what BUDS is designed to do. You either choose me or we, and they want the people that choose we, because it's a team. And in combat, you need your team. You need the guy to the left and right, not the me. I was going through my own little injuries at the time, and they told me, hey, look, you're going to get rolled back. And I said, I'm not rolling back. I'm done. And so I gave up on myself. Joe Rogan said it best. He said that we are so stuck on our past failures that we can't understand how they built us up for our future successes. And it took me forever to understand that that failure at BUDS, because I was so disgusted with what happened there, that when I went through special forces training, I never was going to go back to that disgusting part of my life again. And so it actually paved the way for me to become a Green Beret. And so, yeah, both extremely tough programs. But if I never had that moment in my life where I was like, God, dude, that is, why did you do that? Then I would never have been able to grow from that. It still bothers me. It does. But, you know, if everyone who went to BUDS was a Navy SEAL, then it wouldn't be the Navy SEALs.
Yeah.
Because those dudes, they're hard. They're hard. So.
And it's interesting how much the mental game plays out here, because as you said, you were physically ready. And from what I've read, a lot of guys show up and they're like amazing physical specimens, yeah. Right? Like they train for this. They think they're going to do amazing. And then you see guys that come in and may not be as physically gifted, but mentally are so much tougher. And it's like at the end of Hell Week, like the ones left standing are typically, if not exclusively, the ones with the mental toughness.
It's probably exclusively, because Hell Week is meant to, regardless of what phenomenal athlete you were, because in my class, there were some studs, Division I wrestlers. You were probably the epitome as a Division I college wrestler. Once it came to the mental part of it, once they got out of that part that they had no longer, because for me, what it was is I controlled everything up until I got to a point to when you're so tired, you're so cold, you're so beat down, you're so chafed, you just ran through the mud to where you no longer have control. And that's when it goes from the me to we part. If I could have adopted my mindset to my boat crew, now it's a we instead of a me. And if I could have made it one evolution at a time, or just make it to that next meal instead of looking at five straight days of this, then it would have been different. But my mind was really weak. And so instead of going back to day one, phase one, I was like, no, I'm not going back. And that was it. Hell Week, it's all mental. It's all mental. I don't care what you've done in your past as a stud. You will not go through Hell Week on physical attributes. It's impossible. About Tuesday night, maybe Wednesday morning, I don't care how physically fit you are, you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, now it's we.
What's that feeling like when you tap out, right? I imagine at some point there's like a brief feeling of relief, right? And then was it instant regret right after that?
I never got the relief. It was all regret. The minute that I made that decision, I regretted it instantly. There was no relief. And I regretted it for years, years and years and years. And people have talked to me. They're like, why, dude? It's a training program. Who cares? It doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with whether it was BUDS or it was wrestling or special forces or what it was. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the decision that I made at that point in my life. So you could have been anywhere in any situation in your life. And the decision that I made, you know, to quit on myself was, again, that's what bothered me. It wasn't the fact that it was at BUDS or if it was here or there. BUDS just happened to be the place I was at because it's one of the hardest training pipelines in the military, you know. So
what do you think differentiates people, like when they're making a decision to quit something? Like what do you think, at what point is it a good decision saying, hey, you can quit, no regrets, versus they're about to quit on something that they might regret for the rest of their life?
you're always going to have regrets if you quit. Now, when people go through a course like with Special Forces, they'll make it all the way through the selection process. So 21 days. Selection is basically a hell week, but it's a long duration. But at the very end, they've made it through all this and they're still standing at the end and they're told, hey, look, you're not what we're looking for. Or you go 2.5 years through training, you get the Robin Sage, you finish Robin Sage for the instructors to tell you, hey, look, thank you for trying out. You're not what we're looking for. And that's 2.5 years of your life gone. But the difference, I think, between quitting on yourself and not making the cut is this. If you gave it everything you possibly had, and that's what I learned from Buds. If I give it every single thing I have, leave it all out there. I have nothing left to give. If I don't make the cut, then I know that I gave it all I had and I will hold my head high. I will not quit on myself like I did at Buds. And so I learned that lesson, you know, from Buds, which set me up for success in selection and then further on in the Q course, because selection's not the hardest part of the Q course. Oh no, it's not. But it set me up for success further on because I knew, hey, look, if I don't make this, if I gave it everything that I have mentally, physically, emotionally, everything, if I leave it all out there, then there are no regrets. And if everybody who is just left standing in the end is going to get a Green Beret, then it's not special. There has to be that point like, hey, man, look, thank you for trying, but you're just not what we're looking for. You didn't make the cut. That's one thing. And then quitting, that means that you could have done more. You could have kept going, but you decided that you were done. And so I think there's always going to be some sort of, it may not be regret, but questions about stopping before you're actually done or giving it everything you have and you just don't make the cut.
Because there's got to be someone asking, like, well, how do I know if I've got more in the tank? You know you had more to give, right? And you quit.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to die. And the military, believe it or not, as chaotic as it seems, whether it's Hell Week or it's selection or I know PJs and combat controllers go through a very horrendous training pipeline too. Very physically demanding. Marine Recon, same thing. But they are so regimented. The instructors are held to such a high standard. You know, whether it's we're taking temperatures of water or med checks or whatever it is, like in selection, we're constantly talking to you, like, let me hear you, like, answer the question. But you can't comprehend all that because you're beat down and you're hungry and you're tired. And like, the Army does something the Navy doesn't do. The Army holds food from you. And that's horrible. The Army loves to make you hungry and tired and cold, wet, and whatnot. The Navy, you'll be beat down, cold, wet, beat down, tired, but you're going to be fed. In the Army, they're like, yeah, we can hold food too. But if you can understand that you're going to be fine, like physically, you will be fine, which is very, very hard to understand that when you're going through those, that mental minefield of the training. But if you understand that, then you're more apt to push even further, because if you do drop, you're going to be taken care of. Very rare for people to die in training. It happens, but it's rare.
The person listening is probably someone shaking their head thinking, why do they have to be that intense? Why that level of selection? Why put somebody through that? What happens if you don't go through that level of just training, preparation, that level of intensity?
I believe that when we are cold, wet, tired, hungry, tired, and then you start to train, it's because of combat. And so when you're in a tick or troops in contact or you're in a firefight or whatnot, the minute that 7.62 starts cracking, your adrenaline takes over. And people talk about the fight or flight. And you can train fight, but it's very hard to train it. And it's very hard to get as realistic as actual combat in training. But the closest that we can get is they beat you down until there is nothing left of you as a man or a woman. And then you start to train. And the reason for that is when those rounds start cracking or people start getting hit and you got explosions going off because an ambush is very scary. I mean, it's initiated by PKM, then RPGs, then mortar fire starts walking in because they go far, then they go near, and then they split the difference. When they split the difference, you're in trouble. But for you to be able to fight through that fog of war, you can't think through it because your mind shuts down and adrenaline takes over. So they call it muscle memory. And then you start to react on all of your training. But it's not training when it was warm. It was perfect. Your muscle memory is from when you were just beat down. And you can't even remember how you trained. Like, what did we do? I don't even remember, dude. I was a zombie. But, you know, that's when you start training. And then all that training kicks in once that 7.62 starts cracking and RPGs are going off. And so that's why, you know, we special operations is such rigorous is because they have to get as close to combat as they can get. And when you're in a special operations community, you're more than likely going to be the ones that are going to deal with the brunt of combat.
I want you to quantify this in the sense when you say beat down and you're withholding sleep. It's like, is it an all-nighter and then withholding food? Like, when is the last time you slept and when is the last time you ate? Like, I guess to put in that scenario, like in that moment.
I remember in selection, I think we counted up the total hours we slept, and it was a ridiculous amount. It was like getting 2 hours of sleep a night. And
which probably isn't that bad the first night or the second night.
Right, but it's not a straight 2 hours. 15 here, 30 here, you know, because you're constantly moving. And then your calorie intake for what your body is actually putting out is so much higher. And if I was an instructor, I would know because they know exactly, like, all right, hey, we need to put them down for this amount. Okay, let's get them up. A few flashbangs. We're back going at it again. But going through the training, I mean, pulling a 72-hour with three MREs, all the water you can drink. Oh, they'll hydrate you. That's not a problem. But yeah, the Army likes to hydrate you to a point to where it's just obnoxious. But holding food and sleep and just beating you down all day, every day. So
did it impress you? I just like once you kind of realized what the human body could take and really endure. I think a lot of people don't really have an appreciation for just how much punishment you can undergo and like how long you can go without sleep, without food. Now your decision making is probably compromised.
Yeah.
You know, without a doubt, you're a zombie, but
yeah,
you're still alive.
Yeah, no, the human body can take a lot. It was pretty surprising to me, especially, you know, when the dust cleared at selection. And we had just finished our 33-mile trek, and it was like, all right, dust had cleared. We're waiting to figure out who got selected and who was a non-select and whatnot like that. I was looking back to the best of my ability because, again, we were pulling like probably like a 48-hour. But I do remember thinking, I was like, wow. Like, I had no idea I could do that. I just kept moving, just right, left, right, left, right, left, right. When I went through, we had a trek. And so selection differs from BUDS in one way, in many ways. You know, BUDS, a lot of water. Selection, you don't have to be a great swimmer, which is perfect for me because I found out in BUDS that I don't really like the water that much. But it differs in the yelling and screaming aspect. So at BUDS, it's very in your face. You're yelling and screaming and in that chaos, that fog of war. At selection, it's different. It's mental. So they'll put a whiteboard up and they'll write directions on it. And they're like, follow the directions. And it may seem easy, but you're like, well, wait a second. It just tells me to follow the cones. It doesn't give me a time limit. It just says, do your best. And follow the cones till I'm told to stop. Well, wait a second. What do you mean? Just do your best? Well, that doesn't make any sense. And then the other rules from the other day, don't talk to other students. Selection was very, very mentally tasking because there really is no yelling and screaming. Just like, hey, do you want to be here? I mean, yeah, grab the log, man.
And you don't know if you're following cones for a mile or 30 miles.
Yeah. So like on the trek, we all war game selection, you know, students went through before. We're like, all right, it's probably going to be like 20 miles or something like that. It's not a problem. I think the trek's 12 hours, something like that. Well, I can finally see the lights. It's still dark out. I can finally see the lights. So I'm looking up ahead and you see the finish point because we all have these GPS little trackers on us. I was just so tired, but I just kept following the cones, just left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. And I saw the lights. Oh man, this is great. So adrenaline spikes again and I start my little trot. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do it. And then I finally, you know, and you can see the lights and they make a huge bright, such an emotional thing. Like, I'm gonna do it, man. I'm gonna finish. And you can see, you know, I start getting closer and there's the Gatorade buckets and bananas and all this stuff. But there's a whiteboard there. Oh, maybe it's congratulations. And I get up there and it's like, do not stop. Continue following the cones. Are you fucking kidding me, man? I just did this. And guys quit just like that.
God.
And I just was like, all right. So left foot, and just kept. And I maybe went another mile, mile and a half, and then truck came and picked us up. And they're like, all right, you're complete. It's like, well, where were we following the cones to? Nowhere. You're done. Get in the truck. Put your rucks in the trailer. What? And that's a big thing with SF, is it's mental. Like, do you want to be here? Oh, okay, that's cool. If you don't, man, it's not a problem. Yeah. Oh, you do? Okay, it's cool. It's not a problem. We'll see. Well, what do you mean we'll see? Oh, we'll see. Well, yell at me or something. Hit me. Like, what's up? No. This, yeah, you're a good dude. Yeah, we'll see. What? What? And that's worse for me. Like, I can take all the yelling, screaming, and do this and do that. But the, I don't know. How do you think you did? Good. Okay. Yeah, we'll see. Well, did I do good? I don't know. Did you do good? No, come on. You got to stop, dude. It's bad. And when you're tired and hungry and all that, that really, and I've seen guys quit over words.
I mean, because it sounds like it would have been easier if they just told you, hey, follow the cones for 30 miles, right? Because I think then you know, all right, here, I'm going to gauge my energy, you know, yeah. Speed up, slow down. I remember we had Matt Frazier on the podcast, who was like 5-time CrossFit Games champ, and he was dominant. He said the most difficult qualifier they ever had was in the COVID year, where they all had to qualify virtually and remotely.
Yeah.
So they said, hey, just do your best. But he couldn't see how anybody else was doing.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, if it's just me, then, well, how am I going to gauge my effort through this?
Yeah.
And how did you do it? I mean, just was it just one foot in front of the other? Because I imagine some of this was timed. You probably didn't know it was timed.
Yeah.
Right? So
it was all my lessons from buds. And it was like, look, I don't know how I'm doing, because they make a strict rule. If you're caught talking to other students during this evolution, you're gone. And they will. Like, someone will be like, hey, man, you good? Hey, you, roster number, whatever, back of the truck, you're done. You can't stop. And like the basic soldier instinct, like, oh man, my buddy's down right now. He's hurting. I need to check on him. Can't. Why? Because can you follow directions? And that truck's there. I mean, they're not leaving him out there to die. The truck is right. They're watching it. But the minute you stop and like, hey, let me help you out. Now guys do it, you know, but you got to be sneaky about it, because we are, we're human being. But for me, it was the lessons I learned at Buzz. It's like, look, I'm not going to stop. They're going to tell me I'm done. I am never going to say I'm done again. Yeah, and I had to learn that lesson the hard way, which actually set me up for success to become a Green Beret. Because people are like, well, which one's harder? They're both hard. But it depends on how you go through the training. If you're mentally tough, you're going to be fine. If you're physically tough but not mentally tough, you're not going to make it. Either one. And they do that for a reason. And so I kept going because they were going to tell me to stop. I wasn't going to stop, regardless of how fast I was. Because on the trek, you're a zombie. You're not going fast. You look dumb.
We're talking a lot about kind of the training that went into being a Green Beret. But what kind of sparked your interest in, you know, Green Beret? And then even for the people listening, just in background on, you know, who are these guys, right? Like, just Special Forces, like, what does that mean?
My dad in Vietnam had worked with him. He wasn't a Green Beret himself, but he was a crew chief on medevac helicopters for MACV SOG teams. As I started to figure out more and more about what a Green Beret does, so there's a lot of differences. Rangers do this and Green Berets do this. Like, what's the difference? In my opinion, Rangers are the elite when it comes to, if you need this wide area completely cleared, disarmed, and bad guys killed, you send in Rangers. They will kill everything and they will do it extremely good. Surprise speed, violence of action, that is Rangers. Those dudes, 100%. SEALs, same thing. Their tactics are amazing. They are great shooters. They get a lot of good missions because they're good, you know, under the trigger and whatnot. The reason why being a Green Beret was so appealing to me is because of the human domain aspect of it. So anybody can pull a trigger. It's very easy to kill somebody. But being able to sync through your shots, the second and the third order effects of if I pull the trigger here, what is that going to do for filling all the blanks? You know, and so now you're working in the human domain. And instead of going in and kicking doors, which we've kicked plenty of doors, but now you're worried like, all right, if I go through and I trash this village, did I just create a bunch of potential terrorists? Or can we come through, ask the village elder for permission to enter his village? Yes, it's a little bit riskier, but treat him as a human being, because surprise, they are human beings. Treat him as a human being with respect, because again, surprise, people around the world like to be treated with respect. And then maybe we can gain rapport, and maybe we can actually do this instead of pulling trigger and doing this and whatnot. Trigger pulling is necessary. That's the reason why we do. We have Rangers and we have SEALs, because there are a lot of bad guys out there that just need to die. But there is also a domain in war that needs to have an unconventional aspect to it, which is why Green Berets thrive in UW or unconventional warfare. And that is, it's hearts and minds. It's force multiplying. It's getting dropped in behind enemy lines and hostile areas and building up a force through your locals or your indige or whatnot, and building up a force to combat those threats for the greater good. And, oh, by the way, you do it through what human beings respond to: respect, rapport, treating people like they're human beings and stuff like that. Yeah, you don't have to speak the language. You respect me? All right, man, let's talk. You start kicking doors and killing people that don't need to die, again, thinking through your shots, then you probably just created more terrorists that could end up killing your buddy. And so that's what I really liked about being a Green Beret. Everybody has their niche. Rangers are amazing. SEALs are amazing. But Green Berets, we work in the unconventional side of things, to where we do have to think through the human domain. And that really, really appeased me. So,
in becoming a Green Beret, I know there's the whiteboard portion we talked about, but you gotta
that's
speak
just
to,
selection.
Yeah. What, like, how long is this, does this whole process take? And it even had briefly speaking to like the different steps involved.
So, for me, it was from flash to bang. So, infantry, basic, airborne school, all the way through, it was a 2-year process. Our medics are our 18 deltas. I mean, like 2.5-3 years of just training, probably more like 3 years because of all the medical stuff they have to go through. And I was too dumb to do that anyways. I like explosives. I was like, yeah, C4. Boom. Ah, oh, cool. And so that's what I did. But yeah, the phases of the pipeline, and they constantly change it up because you always have to adapt to the new recruits that you have coming in because society changes and your caliber of soldier coming through, they may still be, you know, the dudes that are hard as woodpecker lips. Their mindset may be a little bit different. I'm more techie, or I'm more this, or I'm that. So you're constantly evolving. I went through with instructors that were just like, all right, we are going to beat the crap out of you every step of the way. And if you don't like it, leave. And if you do like it, well, you're probably still going to leave because we hate you. And then I was like, oh, this is horrible. This sucks. Like, good, leave. I don't want to leave, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, it was hard. I mean, it was a physical beatdown. And every time you start a new phase in the Q course, you revert back to day one. It's not like it's like, oh, hey, yeah, I've made it 6 months through the Q course. No one cares. Oh, you're day one phase, whatever. Yeah, you're a new guy that's never done anything before. You're a piece of crap. You're going to get your whole team killed in combat. You might as well quit right now. You suck. It's like, well, I was selected. I don't care. Selection's easy. Wait till, you know, I was like, everyone always says everything I just did was easy until this is like, God, man, when am I ever going to be there? And you never are. And when you get to the team, it's like, oh, you went through Q course is a joke now. You should have went through what I went through. holy cow, man. When am I ever going to go through, like, everyone was that last hard class. Everyone was like, oh, man, what I went through, it was like, oh, God, here we go. And I do the same thing, too. Like, oh, no. When I went through, and guys like, oh, yeah, last hard class ever. Everyone does that. It doesn't matter what branch of the military you're in. Everybody was in that last hard class.
On the way to, you know, becoming a Green Beret, there's team week. It always seems like a team is so important, right? To be someone who's selfless, that really can work together on a team. Mm-hmm. This seems like this selects a lot of people out.
Yeah, it goes back to kind of what they focus on in Hell Week and whatnot like that. That's, you know, I mean, selection is one giant Hell Week, but they really drill in on you in team week. So if there is going to be any, like, in-your-faceness by the instructors, it's probably going to happen during team week, but they don't really do that there either, because you're so depleted as a human being that they don't need to. They just walk up and they're like, huh. And you don't know what they're writing down. I've seen guys quit over that. But team week, it is. It goes back to, you know, kind of what Hell Week does. And I know Marsoft, they have theirs. Combat Control Pararescue, they have theirs too. There's a gut check time. But that gut check time isn't, can I do this? Because nobody can do it individually. And that's when it goes from what I said earlier, is it me or we? And if it's we, you're going to be fine. If it's me, you're going to go away. Yeah.
So what does that mean, though? And I imagine a lot of people that go through this, they believe they're team players. What are the differentiators? What sets people apart in that, you know, me or we decision?
The me or we comes because when bullets are flying and people are dying, the worst thing that could ever happen to me is not me dying. It's my buddy getting killed because of something I did. And so you have to have that we. You have to, or else people can die. When you focus on me and not we, you run a chance of getting somebody killed. And most likely, it could be the guy that's either to your left or to your right of you. And so that's the reason why we focus, like, we want to get the we's. We want to weed out the me's. Me's are good for sports or whatnot, you know, individual competitive things, but we's are not good for, or me's are not good for combat. You have to have we's. The guys that are willing to, like, I'll lay down my life to make sure my buddies go home to their families. And then it's like, okay, you can soldier. I will teach you everything else. You can teach a monkey to do our job. But it's very hard to teach we. Very hard. If not impossible. But if you have that we, like, hey, look, I got it, man. But I want to make sure my team succeeds in team week. It's team week. Then you're probably going to be okay. And instructors see it. Instructors see the spotlight rangers. Instructors see the guys that are, you know, they'll put out when an instructor's around, but when the instructors aren't around, but they are, they're, you know, giving their back a rest or their legs a rest. And then they also see that dude. He may not look the part, but he's always grabbing the heaviest shit. And he's always like, hey, man, I got this. No. You take a break. I got this. And he knows nobody's watching him, even though they are, you know. That's the we aspect, because in combat, nobody cares. You're either for the team or you're not. And you want team players when bullets are flying.
Fast forward 2010. Tell me about your experience as 18 Charlie.
So when I first got to group, it was a rude awakening. So I had graduated the Q course. I'm Green Beret now. It's badass. And I thought, you know, I just like, man, it's going to be smooth sailing from here. I'm going to get to my company and I'm going to get to my ODA and everything's going to be easy. Yeah, because I just made it through all this training, right? No. So I show up to the company. Sergeant Hendrickson here. I'm checking in to the company. I just finished training. I was like, I don't give a fuck. Who are you? Ryan Hendrickson, checking in. Oh, yeah, man. Just go over there, dude. Okay, so I'm over there. I said, man, that's not important, is that the guy doesn't know who I am. I'm Green Beret. So finally, they're like, all right, dude, you're going to this ODA. All right, I'll get down there. These guys will care. I'm a Green Beret. I just went through all this training. Pretty badass. Get down there and knock on the door. This dude opens the door, and he's just in Ranger panties. It's like, who the fuck are you, dude? I'm the your new 18 Charlie. What? We don't have a new 18 Charlie. slam. Like, all right. So what do I do? And then door opens back up and he's like, stand outside. It's your place of duty. Yeah. Stand here. We'll let you know. So I'm just standing there. Then they'd call me in for a thing or two. He's like, hey, what's your name? Sergeant Henderson. Man, your parents are jerks. My name is so-and-so. What's your name, stupid? It's like, oh, it's Ryan. Well, still a stupid name, but yeah, get back outside. Nobody cares. Shut up. What is going on here, man? And so slowly but surely, I mean, that... So it was like standing outside a door for, you know, a week, and then you get let into the team room, and then, you know, it's like your, you know, best piece of advice I got is no one cares what you have to say. We don't care. You haven't done shit in your life. Shut your mouth, open your ears and your eyes and learn, because we're going to war. When I got to my ODA 4 months later, heading to Afghanistan, we're going to war. So no one cares who you are. We're not friends. We're not, because when I got into group, Afghanistan, 2010, that was a big year in Afghanistan. Huge year, most casualty producing year in Afghanistan. Until you prove yourself in combat, no one gives two shits about you at all, because you didn't do anything when bullets were flying. You can talk all you want. You can be the best runner or swimmer or whatever it is, you know, whether you're SEAL or Green Beret or MARSOC or whatever. No one cared until you proved yourself when rounds were flying and it actually meant something. And so, I was just like, wow, I made it all the way through training. Why are you, like, you guys not know who I am? No, and we don't really care. So, because if you're not good, you're going to die, and nobody wants to care.
So then, I mean, I guess you got out there. How did you find yourself as the man up front? Because it's interesting to say, like, that is the place you control. It's where you felt most safe. But yeah. One could argue you're also the first to encounter an IED.
Yeah. So as an 18 Charlie, it's, you know, the demolition expert or whatnot. I mean, the Taliban were extremely good at adapting to our tactics, techniques, and procedures, TTPs. So the Taliban were very good at it. They knew, like, okay, when these guys are coming up on a house, they're going to put security up here, here, and here. Okay, we're going to put IEDs here, here, and here, because we know that this is where they're going to do security. And then they're going to move up on the door like this. They're probably not going to just be up on the wall. They're going to come out at a 45-degree angle. So we're going to put IEDs right here. And then we'll put, they're probably going to step over the threshold. One guy's going to, you know, I mean, the number one man's never wrong. Number two guy, you know, you go the opposite direction, whatnot. But we know kind of how, and so they were able to adapt to our TTPs, and they would IED, you know, those areas. And we learned a little bit about it in the Q course as an 18 Charlie, the only MOS that really did. So you're like, all right. And they're like, all right, you're the IED guy, because you learned all this stuff about IEDs. Like, hold on. And so when I got into country, we had counter IED guys that were Afghans. And those dudes, extremely good. They could look down a road and be like, that's not right. That's not right. That's not right. IED, IED, IED. Like, how do you know? He goes, I just know. Well, how? Well, because I'm from here and I know that that doesn't belong there and that's not right there. It's like, damn. And so I started to learn that, yeah, you have all this equipment and mine detecting equipment, all this other stuff, but I have found the majority of my IEDs with my eyeballs, because it's ground signed. It's something's not right here. Would I put one here? Okay, then maybe there's one here. And all that was learned in Afghanistan, but I ended up in the front because of my MOS. It's like, oh, well, you're the IED guy. You trained on it in the Charlie course. And I was like, ah, not really, but okay. But I ended up loving it because I could control my environment in the front. I can, you know, you're never going to be able to control what the enemy does. But if I'm in the front, the only thing I'm worried about is what I can't control, but I can control everything around me. And so me having that control, it created safety for me. Even though I was probably the first one to get my face canoed in, it created a safety bubble because I had control over being in the front. It's weird to explain, but it's just how my mind works. Like, I control what I can control. And if it's meant to happen, then it's going to happen. You can't control that. Just that's, you know, because I do. I believe that the beginning of your life and the end of your life are written. They're set in stone. There's nothing you can do about it. When you're born and when you die, that's done. but those pages in between, they're all blank. So it's how you're going to fill them out. So if this is how I'm going to die, it's already done. It doesn't matter if I'm in Afghanistan or at home. I will die this day. And there's nothing you can do to change it. And that's my mindset. And so being in the front, if I get my face shot off or whatnot, it was going to happen that way. Because that was, you know, that's my ending chapter of my story.
That's September. You know, you encountered a pretty significant setback.
Yeah. So we had, we were in the Chewti Valley and we were doing just reconnaissance in this valley for months because we were about ready to do a major valley clearance. Intel was like 2,500, 3,000 Taliban fighter in the valley. We were bringing enough ass to the fight. So we kicked off the clearance operation on September 11th. We got up to our set of compounds that we were going to be clearing because we had the southern part of the valley and we were going to be moving north. But we got to our first objectives. We got to clear these first set of compounds. And we have taken fire from these compounds nonstop. So that we know there's bad guys here, but it's quiet. But it's too quiet. There's no dogs. So up front, we're clearing the path to the first set of compounds. And we stop, do one last check of your Afghan counterparts. Like, hey, all right, this is what we're doing. Don't forget that compound, pointy talkie, you know, make sure everybody understands. And it's like, all right, guys, hey, we got about 25 meters. That's compound number one. All right, let's go. Ready, break. They're just standing there. Hey, man, hey. And our interpreter, we called him Nick. It's like, Nick, did you tell him? He goes, yeah, I told him. It's like, tell him again. So he does, you know, we're whispering noise and light discipline and all that. We're like, I see head shaking. I said, no. Well, what do you mean no? They said, it's too dangerous. Well, no shit, it's dangerous. They said, well, you Americans, you're better trained than us, so you guys should go first. It's like, yeah, if this was Texas and we were clearing a village in Texas, yeah, I would go first, my country. But it's Afghanistan. You know, the whole for your country kind of thing. Nope. Shit. So I turned around to tell my counterpart that was with me, his man, these guys aren't budging. They're not going to move. And he's like, hey, what is Nick doing? What are you talking about? He goes, get him away from that compound right now. So I turned around and Nick had ran down to the first compound and he's trying to do the Afghan Rambo thing, like, you know, but quiet because we still, I mean, Taliban know you're there. They're not, but they're just still being quiet. He's trying to wave him down. I said, oh, shit. And if you lose your terp, well, you can't communicate with your partner force. And we were broken up into cells to where it was like 12 to 15 Afghans and two Americans. You kind of need to communicate with your partner force. So he was like, go get Nick away from the breach. All right. So I was like, well, I wonder where he stepped because none of this is cleared. And we've seen animals hit IEDs around these compounds like crap. So I'd move down to him and hindsight 2020, maybe I should have used my mind detector. Ah, but it's hindsight. So I'd move down to him and I grabbed him. It's like, Nick, you know, wrong move, dude. Move back. He goes, no, we can take this compound. Come on. They'll come now that you're here. It's like, no. We got to move back and regroup. This will be completely unorganized if we, you know, and chaotic. And we don't want that. Clearance should be smooth. So I pulled him away from the breach point. And you don't ever want to have your blind side to the unknown. And so my blind side at that time was when I pulled Nick away and I pointed back to where to go. So now my side is exposed to the breach. And all someone has to do is just poke an AK-47 out there, spray, and I'm going to take some rounds in my side and I'm dead. So you put your plates to the unknown and your gun to the unknown. So I cover his movement back to where all the guys were at. And then I caught something out of the corner of my eye. It's like movement. I don't know if it was a dog. I don't know if it was a person. I don't know what it was, but I wanted to shoot somebody. And, you know, because you're amped. You know you're in bad guy territory. You know they're watching you. You can hear them on ICOM chatter. And I see this movement. So I step inside the breach and boom. And they had an IED right there in the doorway. So I stepped on an IED that was in the doorway. Why? Because they know our TTPs. They know how to play with our minds. They're very good at that. And so the IED goes off and I can't figure out what happened. It's just like, what in the hell happened? and it didn't hurt. And I was like, okay, so maybe I'm good. And granted, it sounds like this is a long time, but this is all seconds. And so I'm laying there and I can't breathe because the dust, the ammonia explosion went off. And I was like, I need to get fresh air. I'm going to suffocate. Why can't I move? God, man, I can't move. I got a 50-pound assault pack on full of demo and everything like that. I'm got my M4 and everything. I'm a heavy dude, but I can't move. So now I'm getting pissed. It's like, why can't I get up? Every time I try and get up, I keep falling over. So I'm able to calm myself down. This can't be that bad. What happened? Then as the dust starts to clear, I look down and my boot was at a 90-degree angle to my leg. And I remember I was like, huh, well, how'd that happen? I didn't take my boot off or anything. So again, real curious dude over here. So I grab my leg from behind my knee and I lift up on my leg and my boot flaps over. And these two like pearly white objects are sticking out of my pants. Again, maybe it's that too stupid to quit thing. I'm like, huh. I mean, those are really white because bone out of your leg or arm or whatever, it's whiter than white. It should have its own color. Maybe it's called bone. I don't know. But I was like, huh. And then my boot flopped over to where like the heel of my boot was hitting me in the hamstring. And then I was like, oh, that's my leg. Boom, pain hit me just like that. It's all gone. Okay, you know, and it's, oh man, it hurts so bad. But it was funny because it's like, I was able to psych myself out so much because I didn't know what was going on that it didn't hurt. And then when I realized it hurt, my mind was like, oh, yeah, yeah, let's hit these pain receptacles. That's right. Our bad, dude. We should have been doing this whole time. And man. So, you know, you do the whole thing you see on movie, you know, medic, I'm down, you know, stuff like that and whatever. But it was just, it was crazy how it was like, it didn't hurt at first. And it's like, I wonder what happened.
And like initially, these guys can't run to your aid, right? I mean, they don't know if there's other IEDs, like, you know, they don't, you don't know the situation.
So the Taliban also know that we will send 100 service members to recover one. And if 99 of them die and we recover that person, it's mission success. We will not leave a soldier to fall in the hands of the enemy. And they know this. And they also know that we value life. And they value death. And so if they can die this glorious death, then that is the same as us saving our buddy. And we will, our adrenaline will take over, will override your common sense, and they know this, and you will run down there to save your screaming buddy that could very well die if he doesn't. And so the Taliban are like, huh. So the Americans, they value life. Okay, so we're going to put multiple IEDs in the area. So a rescue team, if they run straight to his aid, they're going to hit all these IEDs. And now we got like 10 dudes on the ground. Perfect. And so very smart. And so they actually play on our value of life so much to where the IED I hit, there were secondary IEDs all around me. And so that's why in the military, we train self-aid, buddy aid. You have to be able to provide self-aid to yourself first because you can't just run down to the dude. You run after him, now you're a target. Now you're hit. Now the team has to recover two, not just one.
Once you realize basically your leg's been blown off, like what's your thought process? Are you thinking, man, it's over? Or this is it for me entirely? This is it for my career? This is like, or I need help and bring the morphine that, you know, that you soon learned that, you know,
yeah,
morphine was not for you?
Yeah. No, as I was laying there, I remember, you know, the guy that was on my team, as he was on the radio, like, hey, we got, you know, Ryan hit an IED, got a man down. Because the very first thing you do is security. Your buddy can be bleeding out if guys are getting hit all around you. Then you're not doing them any good. Security has to be up. Well, he knew that I had wandered into an uncleared area and there was IEDs. Where there's one, there's five or three or 10, you know, who knows? Yeah, guys are starting to move from where they were at in their position because we were spread out all over the village. They're starting to move back. Now it's like, oh shit, we got IEDs in the area. So we need to retrace our steps back. We need to get to this point. We need to clear up the Ryan. Oh, by the way, we have ICOM chatter that the Taliban are going to put in an ambush on us. okay. And so I'm laying there and I remember, I'm like, my team can't get to me. And it was a very helpless feeling. And I kept trying to put my tourniquet on, but I couldn't. I was like, what is going on, man? Like, I just don't have the strength. And so I remember I laid back one time and I looked over and all the chaos was in slow motion. Dudes were running here. You could see guys pointing, you know, getting security up. I laid my head back and I was like, I'm going to die here today. And I don't know why, you know, number one, I'm not a doctor, so I can't look down on my leg and be like, oh, that's just a fill in the blanks. No, tons of pain, you know, and I see red stuff everywhere, which is meat and blood and all this other stuff. And yeah, and my team can't get to me, but it's a very sobering moment in your life when you know you're going to die. All this shit just hits you and you're just like, damn.
So they finally get to you, right? They give you like a fentanyl lollipop and then the morphine, right? Yeah. As soon as they give you the morphine, you break out in hives. You mentioned in the book that usually, like, if you can just hang on for an hour, mm-hmm. right, you're okay. But this was longer than an hour.
Yeah, so it's called the golden hour. And basically what that means is from you getting hit, we have an hour. Like, you have the highest survivability rate within 1 hour. So when you plan your missions out, you're like, all right, we're going to be here in the Chutu Valley. I know that I could medevac him from here to TK, or Tarancout, within an hour. If he gets hit here, he'll be at Tarancout within an hour. His survivability rate is in this level, okay? If it's over an hour 10, hour 15, whatever. And again, I'm not, I didn't study these charts, but I know it starts to drop dramatically once you go over that golden hour. And so, yeah, by the time I got fished out of there, my rate had dropped pretty dramatically just because of the amount of IEDs in the area, the Taliban. Our overwatch position was actively engaging the Taliban fighters that were trying to move in on our position. Because Taliban, again, they're smart. If they could close the gap between their position and our position, that limits us dropping bombs on them, or else we're dropping bombs on ourselves.
You wake up in the trauma center. Mm. At that point, you know, you've been through surgery. You gain an understanding, right, that you're not going to die. You're going to live. But does a different wave of regret hit you at that point, thinking, okay, I'm going to live, but, you know, now how am I going to live?
I had this overwhelming feeling that I let my team down. I know that when I woke up in Tarancout or TK, it didn't quite hit me that my life was forever changed, because I was, you know, I was completely whacked out on drugs and whatnot like that. But I remember being very emotional that I had let my team down. I failed my team, you know? And so that was that F word again, the failure. There was a lot of emotional like pain there, because I just kept thinking about everything. The whole hindsight 2020, you know, it's like, well, I could have done it this way, or I should have done, you know, but you didn't. But I couldn't think through all that. And so, yeah, I beat myself up pretty hard in the hospital there.
And then kind of what follows next is probably about a dozen surgeries, and just like that whole process of the surgeries themselves, then rehab. And I'm curious, because at that point, even after having gone through the surgeries, for all accounts, you could be medically retired. You can go out and say, you know, you did a great job. Yeah. Everything's all good. But having gone through that, you got this wild idea, right? I think most human beings, honestly, the story could probably end right there. And I think it's still incredible, and it's incredibly inspiring. But for whatever reason, like, I'd love, you know, to hear it, but just, you didn't stop there. You decided, okay, I'm going to come back.
Remember that whole too stupid to quit? Okay. So yeah, 27 surgeries on my right leg. And because it was a battlefield amputee. And then when I actually got blown up, was a pretty good year to get blown up. Like, if you're going to do it, 2010 was a good year to do it. They were starting this whole limb salvage thing. So I went through the limb salvage program, and I was a test subject for a lot of the technology that's out there today, because, you know, I came in, they were like, hey, look, your limb is really bad. Like, you should not have a leg right now, but we're going to try and keep your leg. And I signed a bunch of waivers for it and everything like that. And then, hey, if it doesn't work, you didn't have a leg anyway. So what's the big deal? I was like, ah, very good point. So there was one incident that happened when I was laying on the ground and the team finally got to me. Number one concern of any guy that steps on an IED is my dick still there? And it's just the way it is, because we're men. And so go from that to like, hey, man, your leg, like you need to worry about your leg and everything. But then on the ICOM, so ICOM is the radio system that the Taliban use. Well, it's only FM radio. It's not secure. So if we have an FM radio and we find their channel, we can listen in. And they were celebrating and laughing about me getting hit with the IED. So that really bothered me. It's like, all right, hold my beer, dude. Watch this. And so when I was rehabbing, there was two things that happened. My sergeant major came and he saw me one time and he said, hey, if you can get medically cleared, I'll send you back to war. Now, when he said that, there was zero way I was getting medically cleared. I was actually getting medically retired out of the military. It's like, okay, confidence.
And then, do you think he said that just to encourage you, or did he actually like want to see you come back?
So him and I are really good friends now. I think I was bothering him so much that he did. He definitely wanted to encourage me, but it probably wasn't. It was definitely something that was not going to happen. Like, you are unfit for military duty. But then the drive, because the Taliban were laughing at me and celebrating. And so I had my sergeant major's word that if I could get cleared, he would send me back to war. And then I had this I need to show the Taliban. And when I got back, they weren't like, oh, he did it. All right. Yeah. Come kill us, dude. Badass. That's like, nah. But in my mind, that's how it was going to work. I dove into, recklessly dove into rehab and to put some semblance of Ryan Hendricks and 18 Charlie back together again so I could get back. I'll deal with all the personal stuff and I'll deal with the mental side of all this once I get back, but I need to get back to Afghanistan. And so, yeah, I just put everything into it.
Man, and when you're going through this rehab process, you talk about the fact that the thin line between drive and stupidity. What did you mean? Yeah.
So there is a thin line between drive and stupidity. You can drive so hard to where you hurt yourself even worse. Not giving myself the proper time to actually heal. My rehab and whatnot like that, I had world-class people working with me, whether it was my orthopedic surgeon or my physical therapist, more the guy that created the IDEO device and all this other stuff. They were world-class, second to none. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a thin line between drive and stupidity, but stupidity will still get you there somewhat. It just may not be good for you.
It's tough to say, like, you know, use the word like luck in any of this, but you mentioned that IDEO device, right? That prosthetic in this kind of journey, that was a bit lucky, right? Because you were one of the first soldiers to even be outfitted with these prosthetics that had it happened at a different time.
Yeah, it was generation one and with the IDEO devices. And it was a lucky break for me that, you know, I got blown up. When I got blown up, I stepped on an IED that was a higher quality HME. So it's called RE factors. And so you can have explosives that have the explosive pushing effect of TNT or dynamite, or you can have explosives that have the cutting effect of C4. And I stepped on one that had more of a cutting effect. So if I would have stepped on the same size IED that was more of a dynamite charge, then it just would have shredded everything. And there's nothing they could have done with my leg. But I stepped on something that just shot straight up through my leg, exited out at my calf, and it was a good cut. And so I was like, all right, bomb maker. Thanks, bro. Good hookup, dude. Whereas in if he's a lower quality bomb maker, it's just going to shred you. And you're just going to be looking at just meat shreds. So I did. There was a lot of luck that came in with me actually saving my leg. And so it was when I got blown up, it was the IED that I stepped on. And it was the me getting sent to the facility I did in San Antonio, Brooks Army Medical Center, and the quality of staff that was there. I mean, second to none, world class. So yeah, there is a lot of luck.
But not everybody was supportive of you coming back, right? I mean, I imagine there obviously there were some, but I mean, most were probably saying, you know, Ryan, I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, most were actually saying, Ryan, that's not a good idea. So the some that were supporting me was like my dad. My dad knew I needed to get back to combat. I needed to prove myself or it was going to haunt me for the rest of my life. But like even through the rehab process, it's like, hey, look, man, you're setting your standards so high that we're worried that when you don't go back to combat because you're probably not going to go back to combat. It's going to mentally destroy you. We need you to have some sort of management expectation. You need to be able to understand, like, here's your injuries. Here's the chances of you going back. These chances dwarf these chances. So you need to quit putting everything in this 5 to 10 percentile and start to think about this 90 percentile over here, because it's management expectation. And I understand that. It's smart. You have to be able to manage your expectations. But I didn't care, because it sounds like a great success story, but it's also very dangerous. If you go down that path and you don't meet that expectation, that's a mental health nightmare right there. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, I recklessly went for the 10% chance of going back to combat and didn't even think about, well, if this doesn't work, I didn't have any backup plans. It was all or nothing. And it sounds like a success story, but it's very dangerous. And so, yeah, I definitely recklessly pursued going back to combat. Even when I got cleared and I was able to weasel my way onto a flight back to Afghanistan in 2012, when I showed up, the team there was like, what are you doing here, dude? You are a liability to this team right now.
So that surprised me, right? You would think you come back and they're like, man, Brian, welcome back, man. Like,
not in combat.
Let's do this. But yet they were concerned, right? They were concerned about your ability to perform. And it's interesting just from a team and leadership dynamic. How did you dissect that?
So it was hard, because again, it was just like going to the team room thinking there was going to be a ticker tape parade for the new guy out of the Q course. It was hard because it was like, what are you doing here, man? You think this is a Make-A-Wish Foundation for Green Berets in combat? It's not. You can't come here and pew-pew a few times and then go home and everything's great. Like, you're putting people's lives at risk, because, again, it's the we, not the me. But I wanted to get back to combat so bad because I was so focused on the me. And I didn't really stop to think, like, oh, am I a liability to the team? And when I got back, I got sent to the most IED'd area in Afghanistan, which was Panjwai District, Kandahar Province in 2012. And so there was IEDs everywhere. Dudes were getting blown up left and right. And yeah, and so when I got to the team, they're like, what are you doing here, man? That's when I started proving myself and hey, and, you know, whatnot like that. And over a period of time, it's like, okay, hey, we're glad you're back. But it could have gone either way. And they were absolutely right. Why are you here? Like, why didn't you send us a good 18 Charlie with both legs? And you have to understand that, because it's combat and people die in combat.
So like, there's obviously the physical component, which you were able to rehab, you know, get back on the ground. But what about the mental aspect? I mean, after having your leg blown off and now you're right back on the ground, were you worried about how you'd respond? Like, just, you know, if you were to encounter something like that again?
It's impossible to step on an IED or to get shot and come back exactly the same way you were before, because before you got hit, you were ignorant to what getting hit was about. After you got hit, now you know what it's about. It's a mental minefield. And so in the first couple of IEDs I found, in the full range of motions, you know, and it's just like, why? What am I doing, man? Why do I have to keep proving this to myself? Are you that dumb? And it's like, oh, yeah, you are. So
there's a part in the book where you talk about this Hilltop 2000 mission and after having gone through what you went through, right? And like all the adversity you overcame, I imagine it was difficult when you'd hear people complaining about anything, right? Just just the difference of perspective.
So why we called it 2000? Because in little under a click, there was 2000 feet in elevation gain. So basically we were going straight up to put up this observation post for this major valley clearance. And I was going up there with the command element. And so they needed an 18 Charlie. I had had an incident that happened on, you know, the team that moved me to the command section, because my last mission in Panjwai, we were in a firefight and I jumped in a ditch full of human feces. And I had open blisters and those skin grafts on the bottom of my foot was hanging open and skin graft on my leg was rubbed raw. And so during this entire firefight, I'm sitting there, I'm like, man, it really stinks. Ah, man, it stinks. Ah. And then once I figured it out, I was like, oh, I just jumped in a shit trench. So then I had to get medically evacuated. You know, once we got back from the mission, they sent me back to cash. And then command was like, hey, you're going to be here. Deployment's getting ready to end, you know, and so you're going to hang out here with the command team so we can watch you. Well, there was this big valley clearance coming up, and it was the last time for the command to get in their last hurrah. Like, yeah, we went out and we did stuff with guns, because they don't. It's command is on base, and they do a lot of that stuff. And our command was amazing. Amazing group of dudes. They were going to go up this hilltop, and 2,000 feet in elevation in under a click. And the first sergeant came up to me. He's my buddy now, but he's like, hey, you show me how to work this mine detector? I was like, what? He goes, yeah, I guess I'm going to clear the pass. Well, why don't you just take me? They're like, I don't know, man. So I was able to weasel my way onto that mission, and I knew that if I beasted that mission, regardless of what happened to me in group, the command element knew what I had done. They would see me on that mission, and I was pretty much good to go, because this was going to be one of the hardest infills that I've ever done, and it was. But so I was able to get myself on that mission, and oh man, Hilltop 2000. Oh, that sucks so bad. Super horrible.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, just listening to you, because this is one of those things that I'm sure that not everyone would want to volunteer for, right?
Yeah.
And you're chomping at the bit thinking, man, let me weasel my way in here. Yeah. And again, throughout all this, you're not getting any special treatment.
Mm-mm. No. I mean, it's combat. There is no special treatment. And it's, you know, it's either you carry your load or your liability. And we better not find out you can't carry your load on mission. So if you can't do this, don't come. Be a man and don't show up. That is hard. Like, as a man, you want to be like, oh, I can do everything. But once you start putting people's lives at risk, you need to be able to take that, you know, that pregnant pause, take a step back and be like, I don't think I have it in. Like, I'm going to be a liability if I do this. And I learned a lot of that after I got blown up. But I was still never able to say I'd be a liability.
You closed this out, I think, in 2016. What got you back to the front, right? That mission, because at that point, I mean, was there anything left to prove?
So the 2016 mission, I've almost died in this country. We've been in tons of firefights. There wasn't really anything left to prove. Once you get in a good enough fight, you are always chasing that adrenaline rush, that brush with death. And so you're constantly chasing the dragon. So I had an opportunity to go back to Afghanistan in 2016 with a different company. They needed an 18 Charlie. And he's like, well, I'm an 18 Charlie, found a lot of IEDs, so I would like to go. And so that deployment right there, I caught the dragon. It was a mission in Bagram province. And that mission alone, I ended up just myself. I found 14 IEDs. My Afghan counterparts found over 50. We had been in multiple firefights, multiple ambushes. And yeah, I caught the dragon that mission. Yeah.
And I know you said earlier you love explosions. I mean, you had explosions too.
Just from the beginning, when we infilled in, we were getting ready to hit our first objective. And to get to this objective, you had to go through an orchard. And everyone knows in Afghanistan, orchards are super bad news. Booby traps, whatever. So as we started moving through this orchard, and again, I'm up front because I'm an 18 Charlie and I got my Afghans with me. We are looking for IEDs and we hit a tripwire IED in the very front. So we hear this loud snap. So everyone hits the deck like you're supposed to. And it's like, sniper, like anyone hit it? Like, we're good. Well, we're trying to get this fishing line off us. Like, what is all over us? And we realize, oh, we just hit a tripwire IED at chest level. It's like, frat, man. And it didn't go off. The blasting cap went off, but the actual wall charge didn't go off. And if it would have killed us all, because it was just bolts, nails, nuts, everything. It's like, okay. So keep pushing on. Like, adrenaline rush, all right. Calm down. Mission hasn't even started yet. Haven't even hit the first objective. Calm down. Okay. Still got to make it to this compound. Move probably about 20 more feet, and I see this movement. This figure darts across this open area. It's like, whoa, what was that? So your gun comes up, and next thing I know, this burst of flame comes out of the wall, and it's about 20 meters from me, and it's a PKM, so a PKM machine gun. So 7-6-2 just starts all around us. Rounds are coming in everywhere. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning, so they can't see us, but we can see them. We have night vision. And then, well, they also, I didn't realize this, they also had limited night vision. So this PKM opens up, and then this entire side of the compound wall opens up. AKs just blasting at our position. Under night vision, it just flashes everywhere. You got AK over here, and then RPG fires off. It's like, holy shit, man, we're pinned down in the orchard. And the remainder of the element was still making their way to the orchard because you clear ahead of the main element. And so they're pinned down too because the Taliban had put up what we call a L-shaped ambush. Pretty good. And so we're cut off in the orchard. Then over ICOM chatter, they're saying, hey, there's an American. He has the flashing helmet. And so I had an IR strobe or an infrared strobe on my helmet, which you can't see unless you have night vision. Well, the Taliban commander had night vision. So he was trying to put fires down on me. He was trying to coordinate fires onto me. And they yelled at the radio. They're like, Ryan, get that IR strobe off your helmet. It's, oh, shit. So I tore it off and I threw it, you know, as close as I can get to where the PKM was at to help our JTAC coordinate an airstrike onto that machine gun's position. But yeah, we were pinned down and RPG after RPG after RPG, and I caught the dragon. It was the most intense, adrenaline, scary, death, something, whatever a word is for being so scared that you go off of muscle memory. Yep, that's what we were, pinned down in that orchard. And it did. I mean, we couldn't get approval to drop because my position from where the first machine gun was at was 20 meters. So that's not only danger close, that's extremely danger close. Like, you're going to drop on your own dudes. And finally get approval to drop, because if we don't drop, Ryan's dead. And so we were able to drop. Boom. First bomb goes off. And it rocked me. Like, I'm trying to stand up. I keep falling over. The only thing I can quit it to is being drunk. But this was like a drunk, like your skeleton leaves your body, slaps you in the face, then re-enters your body. It was weird. But 500-pound bomb dropped 17 meters from my position. Finally, it's like, all right, get the guys, fall back to where the main element's at, drop another couple bombs. All right, assault the compound. And I'm sitting there. I'm like, holy cow, I got this liquid coming out of my ears. And what is going on, man? Things are spinning, but you're in combat. And so muscle memory takes over and you're just left, right, left, right, left, right. Same way you do in training, which is why we train the way we do. And that was the beginning of the mission. And so we ended up clearing all of the village. I think it was called Nyazula. We ended up clearing all of the village. We get to our LOA or our limit of advance. I think it was like 1400, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Let's get up on MWE, men, weapons, and equipment. And then we're going to fall back to the vehicles. We've cleared the village, mission complete. And there was IEDs everywhere. There was tunnels. There was fighting positions. There was World War I style trenches. I was just like, holy cow. I mean, were you guys expecting anything? Maybe. Yeah. But we're at the LOA, and one of the commandos, Afghan commandos, comes up to me with a TIRP, and he's like, hey, we have word. We're seeing people that are coming this way. It's like, what do you mean people? Are they women and children? Are they men? There's no children. Okay. All right. Hey guys, we need to wrap this up. We need to go. But at this point in time, we're trying to let the Afghan army know, like, hey guys, you're going to have to hold this area. It's ancient in warfare. Take ground, you hold it. Nope. We don't want to hold it. Well, then why are we here? You have to. So we're having this debate with Afghan forces at the time. And this commando, he's like, hey, the army, they can do whatever they want, but we need to leave now. We have word. There's a lot of guys coming in this direction, a lot of somebody. They're not children. And we keep seeing them and then not seeing them. And so tunnel system. I told the team sergeant, like, hey, man, we need to roll. This is what's going on. And it was like within a matter of seconds, the entire tree line, the entire mud wall that was, you know, 50 feet in front of us, everything just erupted in flames and PKM, RPGs, sniper fire, and dudes were dropping, and we just went for cover. You're not worried about concealment, just cover. I need to get out of this line of fire. We need to fight back with overwhelming fire superiority, and we need to take the advantage, the upper hand. And it's like, how do we get that? Well, with air support. Okay, great. What's that? We can't drop bombs? Well, why? Oh, you don't know who's who because they're in our lines. It's like, oh, shit, man. So we're going to have a fist fight here. And so we did. I mean, we went 45 minutes without being able to drop bombs. Now, planes would do show of force. That's when they fly over and they'll shoot flares or whatnot like that, or do low flyovers. But we had stumbled into a Taliban training camp. And crazy enough, we surprised them and they surprised us. And so we're duking it out with these dudes. We didn't have our air support. We start to get casualties coming in. And then you get that dreaded call over the radio, eagle down, eagle down, eagle down. And that's when you know an American's been hit. Whether he's KIA, whether he's WIA, you don't know. And so eagle down is a horrible thing to hear. Horrible. It stops your heart. And so it's like, okay, we got Americans down. And then over the radio again, eagle down, eagle down. And then the radio again, eagle down, eagle down. It's like, holy shit, dude. Dudes are getting hit. We're starting to try and figure out, like, we need to set up a CCP or a casualty collection point. We got to start getting these wounded dudes in here. We got to start getting these dead in here. So CCP's over here. All right, CCP's over here. Well, my buddy, Frankie, and I, we're still up in the front. So we don't see all this going on behind us because we were in the front, which is where the 18 Charlies are. And so now all of a sudden we hear that the most dreaded sound for Green Berets, and I'm pretty sure for SEALs and MARSOC and everybody else too, is the thump of a mortar leaving the tube. And you're like, oh shit, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, boom. So the mortar explodes up behind us. We're like, holy cat, man, 50 meters behind us, like shit, thump, 1,000, 2,000. The mortar explodes in front of us. Well, shoot long, shoot close, and then split the difference, and they're going to bracket you in. So now it's like, hey, we need to leave now. And so we had like three wounded Afghans with us. So we're doing this duck walk through this trench because every time your head gets stuck up, they take shots at you. And we knew there was no IEDs in it because it was like a foot of water. Maybe, I don't know of any underwater IEDs that they've created, but I was fairly certain we weren't going to hit an IED with a foot of water in the ditch. So we make it to the first CCP. It's like, okay, all right, let's get these wounded dudes offloaded. Hey, where do you guys need us? Find work. You got it. Security. And then we start taking rounds into the CCP. And we look over, and there's a two-story building, and they're hitting us with sniper fire from that building. So we're returning fire. Well, the building's far enough away, we can drop on it. So now we got bombs on target. Okay, Taliban knows we have bombs on target now. So now we can start to, you know, turn the tide of the battle, because at this point, we're getting our asses kicked. But we got to move the CCP because we hit that building, but then we start taking fire from a different point. And so we know there's a tunnel system around there somewhere. So we find another area for the CCP, which is running across the fatal funnel again, that road where all the rounds are coming from. And then we find this building that we can secure that has an open field that we can also secure and start getting helicopters down to get the wounded and the dead out. So, okay, secure the CCP. All right. Hey, we're dropping bombs. We've distinguished the lines between Taliban and us. We're actually, you know, once you start putting bombs down, they're going to start to hide. Good. All right. This is our time to pull back. We need men, weapons, and equipment. Not so much weapons and equipment. We need men, headcount. All right. Americans, all accounted for. Good. Afghans, we have three missing. Shit. Well, you can't leave guys behind. Nobody gets left behind. So what do we do? Well, we got to go get them. So it's back down that road again. Rounds going off everywhere. So we go back to the old CCP. Boom, found one guy. Okay, now we were missing two. Where was the last time my Afghan counterpart, Abe, where did we see him last? Well, shit, the last time I saw him was at the footbridge 500 meters up this road that seems to be attracting a whole lot of firepower down it. Why? Because it's aiming stakes. You got the left and right limit of the road. Anything in between it, shoot it. Simple. So it's like, all right, how are we going to do this? And our JTAC, our combat controller, he's like, all right, dude, let me tell you what we're going to do. I got two Apaches. They're going to fly in over the road, and they're going to start gunning up things. We are going to run behind the Apaches to where you think Abe is at, because I'm pretty sure he's there, and we're going to recover these last two Afghans, and we're going to leave, because the Afghans wouldn't go back after him. They were like, inshallah. It's like, no, those are soldiers. We're going to go get them. Nobody gets left behind. I don't care. And so he's like, all right, Apaches inbound. You guys ready? We got one shot at this because we're not worried about them running out of ammo. They're almost bingo on fuel. That's a bad thing. So it's like, all right, one, two, three, boom. Apaches are coming in. Guns are going, 2.75 rockets, whatever. And it's like, all right, we're good. Run. And I'm like, please, leg, hold up. If there's one time I need you to hold up, it's right now. And we're just sprinting down this road. And we get to the bridge. And I look down in the ditch, and Abe and then our missing commando are there, and they're dead. So we recover Abe, and it was hard. I mean, 200-pound man, soaking wet in blood. Blood is very slick, and it's very hard to grab onto a person, especially when you're getting shot at. So we get the commando, and we get Abe out, and we start to move back. We've turned the tide. Air support is pounding the crap out of Taliban reinforcements coming in, and so get everybody back. So now we have all men. Nobody got left behind. And yeah, we pulled back and we're able to get back to our firebase. And at the end, we had 18 Afghans wounded in action, 10 Afghans killed in action, and 4 Americans wounded in action. So it was, we caught the dragon.
It boggles my mind. I mean, in the sense, I know you mentioned no man left behind, yep. But were there any points where they're like, every American's accounted for, we're good?
So I've served with some Afghans that would have died 5,000 times over again to recover an American, 100%. No, there was never a question. The question was brought up about, hey, is there another way to do this? But there wasn't. We have air support on our side right now. It's going to be dark in a couple hours. We have to do this now. We have to go get them now. Yes, it's dangerous. It doesn't matter. No one gets left behind. So no, it was never about, hey, should we go get them? It was, hey, how do we do them? How do we go and get them? And that's what the argument ensued until finally the JTAC was just like, hey guys, look, Apaches are inbound now. Let's go. It's like, roger that. Combat controller said, let's go. We're fucking moving. And because they do, they control all air. They're heroes. Finally got to a point to where it's like, hey, look, man, you can plan something out. Excruciating details in the first round that's fired across your face, that planning is the shit. You know, and I'm pretty sure it could be the same in corporate too. You can plan something out to excruciating, you know, details until that first frag or fragmentation comes in where there's like, well, we didn't think that was going to happen. Then that whole plan is gone to shit. Sometimes you just have to say, hey, bring in the Apaches. We're sprinting behind them. We're going to go get these dudes.
You catch the dragon. Are you ready to go home?
No, because now I want to catch his brother. And so I just kept riding this combat high and riding it. And I went back to Afghanistan. That was 16. I went back 17, 18, and 19 as a Green Beret. And then I went back 20, and I got home in July of 21 as a defense contractor, and you're just still looking for that high, that combat high, that distinct 7.62 crack that just puts your adrenaline into a ride that no drug will ever give you. And it's that I survived. Now I want to survive again and again and again. And it's dangerous. I don't know how it works, but I do know that it is an issue right now with veterans. And it's a very dangerous issue because there are people that are trying to get that high through any means available, including wrecking and losing their own lives to do it.
The bringing things to present day, where your passion lies today, or even maybe just perhaps sense of purpose, because I mean, you're still a young guy, right? You're in your 40s. Yeah. You've got a lot of life ahead of you. Yeah. And it's hard to look back and say, hey, I'm gonna try to keep amplifying what I've just gone through, right?
Yeah. So I've actually thought about this quite a bit, and people think it's funny, but it's the truth. I have no idea what I want to do when I grow up. I don't. I've been military and government in it up since I was 18 years old. being given a task condition and a standard, like, who is Ryan Hendrickson? I mean, my job was a Green Beret, but I am not a Green Beret. I just was a Green Beret as a job. It's just a job. It's a title. It doesn't mean anything. I have these experiences, but everybody has experiences. Okay, cool, man. So you've been shot at. Congratulations, bud. So there's a lot of people. So who am I? I'm on this journey to figure out, like, who do I want to be when I grow up? What do I want to be when I grow up, kind of thing. And I know mental health is very important to me. I've lost a lot of friends to suicide. I see these issues going on in our country today and these unanswered questions that our veterans are going through. Was it worth it? You know, what was it for? And all this other stuff. And the underlining demon with all of this, whether you're military or first responder or whatever, or someone who COVID has just beat you down, is mental health. After I lost my buddy to suicide, I definitely started to think, like, well, I could have easily have been one of the 22 a day myself, because I had a mental point in my life when I was like, maybe it's better if I'm not here. You don't really overcome it, but I was able to understand it to where I can make myself a better man. You know what I mean? Because that's one thing that a lot of people don't understand is you'll see people and they'll have this problem that happened to them. The fact of the matter is you can never undo the past. It will always be there. You can never make something not happen. What we don't focus on enough is how do I adapt my life? How do I make myself better for this situation that I'm having a lot of issues overcoming right now? That's what we don't focus a lot on. A lot of people, they just want to forget about it. Yeah, like it never even happened. And a lot of those techniques are through drinking, through drugs, and a bunch of different outlets that are temporary because this happened. How do you quit blaming, as in my case, blaming everybody for you, you know, for your past, when in fact, guess what? You're not the first guy to ever have a hard past. You won't be the last guy. You are such an entitled asshole right now that you think that other people need to worry about what happened to you. Get over yourself. Understand that, yes, it was bad what happened to you, but bad shit happens all the time. You are not so important to where everyone needs to know, you know? And how about you get over yourself and you start to use, and this is what I'm trying to do now, is you start to use these situations to maybe help people. Because as you help people, you better yourself, you know? You don't better yourself because now I'm going to go do this and that's going to make me a better man. Not for me. Some people may. But I am starting to figure out that by helping people, it helps me. If that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that will say that the best way to impact other people is to start with yourself and be just a positive influence, an example of what is possible.
And the best way to impact people is because you've been there. You can't talk to a guy that hasn't been there. It's like, well, no. I've never thought of suicide before, but I can tell you how not to think of it. Like, man, no, get away from me, dude. Let me talk to somebody. He's been in the dungeon. He's been to that point to where he's like, you know what? This is actually an option. That's a very dangerous point to be at because I've been there. And it's now, how do we not get to that point? Yeah, life is hard. It is. It's really hard. But guess what? No one said it's going to be easy. And part of my stance about it, the minute you understand that you don't deserve shit, nobody owes you shit, you're not entitled to anything, life is hard and sometimes ugly and sometimes very brutal. And guess what? Just because you overcame this doesn't mean you're not going to get hit with something ever again. Oh, and by the way, don't forget, life still doesn't owe you anything. Work for it. The minute you understand that, the minute you can adapt that life can be ugly and it's going to chew you up and nobody cares, that's when life starts to become beautiful. That's when you can actually really start to live and help people, is when you understand that nothing is free. And guess what? Whether you like it or not, no one cares. And I tell this to veterans a lot because they're like, oh, you don't understand what I've been through, or you weren't there, or I defended your freedom so you can do name whatever you hear. I hate it. I hate it when people go down that rabbit hole because you are alienating everybody around you. They want to say, you know, oh man, you don't understand. Thank you for your service. And they probably really mean it. But if you're not doing one of the three F's, if you're not feeding someone, financing someone, or fucking somebody, you're not a life-sustaining thing for them. So they may truly mean thank you for your service or thank you for what you've done. But if you're not doing one of those three F's, they still got to take care of their family. They still got to do life-sustaining functions. You have to. It's life. And if you aren't providing one of those, then guess what? Thank you for what you've done, but I got to get back to my life. I have to. And veterans, some people just don't understand that. And some veterans are having issues with understanding that, hey, look, man, people will thank you and they probably truly mean it, but you're not owed shit, dude. Just because you did this and because you think that you've done something so extravagant that everybody owes you something, you're not owed a thing. You're not. That was a choice you made. Nobody owes you anything. And because these bad things happen to you, guess what? Bad shit happens in life and is going to continue happening. Get over yourself. And that's what I try and really like push off on veterans, because that's what it took for me to climb out of the 22 a day.
I imagine when a lot of people hear this sort of thing, it's like, you're not owed anything. And to the ones that do have, you know, any kind of, you know, mindset of being a victim or any entitlement, they probably don't like to hear that, right? And ironically, you're not telling them this to offend them, to, nope, you know, to hurt them or anything like that. You're actually trying to put them on the path to actually, you know, moving forward.
Well, and not just that, but if you look at our country today, we have a victimization entitlement catastrophe going on. I don't know how else to say it. We're bringing up a youth in our country that is either victimized or entitled to something because they feel like they deserve something. And I see it in veterans too, the victimization mindset, the entitlement mindset. Well, I went through all this victiming. You're a victim to what you think you went through and you owe me this. Now you're entitled. But then you're going to go and you're going to bash the people that you're like, oh, well, why are they out there doing that? You mean the same thing you're doing? But you're using the cloak of military to make your campaign right, but their campaign wrong. It's like victimization and entitlement is dangerous, and it is plaguing our country today really bad because everybody thinks they're owed something for free and life is supposed to be easy.
How do you see this playing out, right? Are there points where, you know, people want to have a sense of, you know, accountability, right? They'll make the argument and say, hey, I just want accountability. I want something recognized. I want to bring about this change. But there's a big difference between that and a mindset of entitlement.
Mm-hmm. And there is a way to go about change that I agree with. I do agree that there are changes that need to be made. There is also a way of doing it. When you throw a temper tantrum because you don't feel that you're getting your way, instead of putting in the hard work to get your way or to get the changes that you want to enact, then you're being an entitled, victimized asshole because that temper tantrum, I'm going to burn down Portland, Oregon because I don't agree with whatever. And I say Oregon because I'm from Oregon. But there is a way to go about change. And it's not easy. And it's hard work because that's life. Life is hard work. And there are changes that need to be made, but it's hard work. And it can't just benefit you. It needs to benefit we, not me. Team mentality. Yeah.
So, Ryan, as we come to a close, this being the Game Changing Attorney Podcast, what does being a game changer mean to you?
I believe that game changers are the ones that look at everything we've done. You've helped better people. And so through writing the book, I feel that part of my game changer has been if one person read that book and they're like, you know what? Yeah, if he can do it, I can do it. And I know people have said that because I've gotten those emails. Then that's the game changer. It's no longer me, it's we. What can I do to help you? What can I do to make this better? And crazy enough, if we had enough we's and not me's, it's number one, contagious. And number two, we may not be in the shitstorm we're in right now. People starting to think about others instead of themselves.
I hope you enjoyed revisiting this episode of the Game Changing Attorney Podcast with our guest, Brian Hendrickson, and have gained new insights from our timeless conversation. If you found this episode valuable, here are three free ways that I can help you grow your law firm. Number one, download the first chapter of my book absolutely free at GameChangingAttorney.com. Number two, you can shoot me a text at 404-531-7691 and I'll answer any question that you've got for me. And finally, number three, if you can leave this podcast a five-star review, it'll help us gain access to more influential thought leaders and bring their lessons learned here to you. For more information on our interview with Ryan Hendrickson, see the show notes for this episode in your podcast app or visit legalpodcast.com.